This is Asia in Focus from Control Risks, the global specialist risk consultancy. Each episode of Asia in Focus brings you in-depth analysis and perspective from our experts in Asia Pacific on the issues that matter most to businesses.
Hi, everyone. This is Angela Mancini, partner Control Risks, and I lead the Asia Pacific Global Risk Analysis team. In what has been called the year of the election, we've recently been discussing a few really large ones, for example, Indonesia and India. But the election that will arguably have the most significant impact on geopolitics and the global business environment is actually the United States. Now, there was some initial speculation as to who the candidates might actually be on both sides, but following Super Tuesday in mid-March, we saw both men win enough delegates from their parties to become the official nominees. And so indeed, we are now seeing a Joe Biden-Donald Trump matchup again. We've seen both of them throughout a first term, and it's indeed the case that they have very different visions for America's priorities and America's role in the world. And the implications of that for global security, trade, and business will be starkly different. So many eyes are watching the U.S. and keen to see what will happen, not just with the election, but more broadly, what it will mean for business and security and economics for the next 4 years and beyond.
I think for Biden, we can expect more of the same on foreign policy, economic and climate engagement with Asia. Trump, on the other hand, has pledged to revert the U.S. back to an isolationist America first economic and foreign policy. As we remember, Trump is much more interested in bilateral engagements in the Indo-Pacific, takes a much more transactional, less diplomatic approach to engaging with our allies. So while there might be some policy continuity on things like getting hard on China, I think the emphasis would be much less on building a consensus-based approach through U.S.-led multilateral partnerships, as we saw in the Biden.
Dan Reshoff, a senior analyst for North America based in our Washington, D.C. offices. Dan spends a lot of time briefing clients about the business impact of U.S. policy and regulation. Those clients, a lot of them are U.S. based, but he's briefing clients from all across countries around Latin America and Europe, right across to the Middle East, and of course here in Asia. So Dan, we're delighted to have you with us and keen to hear your point of view on the U.S. election, what we can expect, and most importantly, how businesses here in Asia should be thinking about and preparing for a new administration, no matter who it is. So Dan, let's just jump right in and get started. Let's start with a really basic question just to set the scene. Why is the U.S. election important for business? What are people looking at?
Sure. Hi, Angela. Thank you very much for inviting me on the podcast. There's certainly a lot to talk about regarding U.S. elections. And I hate to be that U.S.-centric analyst that's telling people to focus on America when, like you mentioned at the top, there's so many important elections happening this year, like 50% of the world's population, I think. But obviously, there are a few factors, like you noted, that make the U.S. election unique and thus very important for companies to follow. The first, obviously, is the U.S. is big. It's really big. Economy-wise, it's the largest in nominal terms. It's also the center of, you know, many global institutions. It's at the forefront of geopolitics and international affairs. So, you know, based on this, who's running Washington is really relevant to countries and companies around the world. But that leads me into my second point, right, is that Biden and Trump, they diverge pretty substantively on ideology, but also on policy preferences, which means that the election of either candidate can create a seesaw-like effect for companies in terms of policies across a range of issues of climate, trade, food safety enforcement, all come to mind, but there's many, many others. Finally, the outcome of the U.S. election, it's also quite unpredictable. So companies need to be prepared for any outcome, including, you know, not only scenarios for the presidential winner, but also for who wins in Congress and what happens in the states, because states, everybody always forgets, will be having their own elections this cycle. And they'll also be passing a lot of referenda on really important policies that are relevant to businesses. So obviously at Control Risk, we have a most likely scenario. That's why we're doing this podcast. But it's not a really high confidence forecast. There's obviously a long time until November, about 6 months at this point, and multiple events between now and then could derail our current assessment. That's why we're going to reassess again over the summer. And then also, you know, as in many recent U.S. election cycles, this one will very likely come down to several tens of thousands of voters across a few key swing states. That's just due to the U.S. electoral system and then also the state of partisan polarization in the United States.
So we are about just over 6 months away from it, but in many ways, it still feels oddly like early days. We get a lot of questions from our clients here, just basically saying, you know, what's our call? What is the Contreras election forecast at this point, and what's that comprised of?
So our forecast for Contreras is basically that Biden will win the presidency. Based on who's running where, we also expect Democrats to flip the House. So Democrats win the House, but to lose the Senate. So Republicans win the Senate. If you've been following the latest headlines, some people may at this point find our Biden pick a slightly contrarian opinion. But, you know, as you request, let me just go over really quickly some of the drivers that we've been monitoring to come to this forecast. The main one is if we just look at recent elections, Republicans obviously won really big in 2016 in the Trump versus Clinton race, where they also held control of Congress, winning tripartite government. But since 2016, have basically lost in almost every single national election since then. Democrats, meanwhile, have had a string of really impressive victories in the same time period, both at the national as well as the state level. Obviously, the big one that we all think of is in 2020, Biden pulled off a massive upset and won against a sitting president. This is very uncommon, right? I believe in 2020, at that time, only 10 incumbent presidents out of the 45 in the history of the country had ever been defeated when running for re-election. But in that, Democrats also held the House of Representatives. They flipped the U.S. Senate and thus gained tripartite control of government, basically meaning they won the White House, they won both houses of the U.S. Congress. So that was really a very successful result. But just as impressively, perhaps even more so than in 2022, Democrats went on to hold off Republicans during the midterms and win what many of us analysts consider to be a pretty historic midterm victory. With very few exceptions, in the United States, the incumbent president's party almost always loses a significant number of seats during the midterms. But in 2022, Democrats, they gained in the Senate, they gained in state legislatures, they gained in state governorships. They did lose the House of Representatives, but that was only by a tiny margin, and they actually ended up winning a number of competitive elections there that they were forecast to lose. And you could even make the argument that Democrats only lost the House because of some strategic errors by New York Democrats. Similarly, in 2018, during that midterm cycle, the Democrats won the 2018 midterm cycle, and they've also repeatedly won, you know, both by being elected, but also a lot of the issues that are kind of, you know, at the forefront of Democratic policies, won in off-year election cycles in 2019 and 2021 and 2023. So if we just look at those last 6 years of election cycles, it's really demonstrated to us here in the U.S. that that anti-MAGA majority just keeps turning out, and it keeps handing victories to Democrats. So that's the main kind of driver that's been animating our forecast. But in addition to that, Biden also has a few key advantages that we're tracking. The first advantage is cash, which helps win elections, obviously. And the cash on hand for the Biden campaign right now is about double that of Trump's. We also think that this advantage will likely be sustained into November because as Trump's war chest is repeatedly drained by legal fees for his many trials, we know from Federal Election Commission filings that he spent about $50 million of campaign money on legal fees in 2023. And these fees are likely to continue in 2024 as new trials are underway, including a current criminal trial in New York State. Trump also owes more than $500 million in civil penalties and other legal judgments pending appeals. And this number could increase before the election if he's found guilty in that New York trial that I just mentioned. We also have seen quite a lot of polling that many independents and Trump skeptic Republicans have said that their votes may be swayed by a guilty verdict in his criminal trials, the extent to which we're still to see. But even if we're talking, you know, 10%, 5%, that's enough to sway a 30,000 vote election. A second key advantage that Biden maintains is that access to abortion is shaping up to be a key campaign issue once again in 2024. This is a very important issue for Democrats, one that they are putting at the center of their campaign. It's one that they believe, and I think most of us analysts agree, that access to abortion as a topic was a massive contributor to Democratic electoral success in 2022 and 2023. Since then, many states have passed laws restricting or preserving access to abortion. And so this has really kept that issue as in the national political dialogue, the forefront of national political dialogue. And importantly, many key swing states, including Nevada and Arizona, will actually include a referenda on abortion on the ballot alongside the Biden-Trump ballot in November. So it's going to keep that issue front and center right up until Election Day. And obviously, you know, Nevada and Arizona and other key swing states, we think that these referenda are going to drive Democratic turnout basically where Biden needs it the most. And finally, the last advantage that Biden has that I'll mention is the economy, which may seem kind of counterintuitive because obviously inflation has been a major driver of negative sentiment toward Biden in recent years. But we do expect that most economic data, from GDP growth to inflation to employment, is going to remain largely positive ahead of the election. And some recent polling that we've seen is starting to suggest that this is beginning to feed into public perceptions and consumer sentiment.
Yeah. Okay. That's extremely interesting to hear it laid out that way. There's also, I know, as you and I have spoken about, the issue of health issues on either side, you know, so again, it's only 6 months away, but it feels like early days, and there could be anything within those various factors that might impact the way Control Risk at this point is calling the election. So broadly speaking, the sense is, for at least from the business community that we speak with, that a second term of Biden would be more of the same that we've seen, while a second term of Trump would be, you know, at minimum, more unpredictable and more transactional. Is that true in your view? And can you walk us through some more detail behind what specifically might be different between the two administrations and what we can expect from a policy perspective?
That's a great question. And I think that the general framework is true that a two-term presidency, the typical structure is that the president spends their first term basically laying the groundwork, passing laws, creating partnerships, and then in the second term, ensuring robust and consistent implementation of their agenda. So on the Biden side, what would that mean? It means kind of similarities from the last 4 years, right? In foreign policy, continued emphasis on supporting and utilizing allies and multilateral institutions to contain China, Russia, Iran. On the economy, it means protectionist trade and technology policies, supporting industrial policy, and also offering preferential market and supply chain access to geopolitical allies and free trade partners. It means sustained commitment to decarbonization on the climate side, stronger environmental regulation across a range of sectors, and then all of those other business regulation priorities will continue as well, such as those antitrust, product safety, financial reporting, labor rights, and sustainability, you know, pretty typical Democratic business regulation priorities. Whereas Trump, on the other hand, he's pledged to revert the U.S. back to an isolationist America First economic and foreign policy, which we saw, you know, play out in his first term. This policy, you know, just to remind everyone, essentially deprioritizes traditional U.S. alliances, deprioritizes multilateralism in favor of bilateral engagements. It will target both allies and enemies with high trade barriers across a range of sectors, particularly if those tariffs are going to help strengthen U.S. manufacturing. And it'll also prioritize the U.S. traditional energy sector over renewables. So I guess a pretty big issue here for companies is that a Trump election over a Biden election would mark a significant departure, kind of that seesaw effect that I mentioned at the very top. We could see a very strong whiplash effect across many sectors as Trump seeks to unroll much of Biden's agenda. But You know, at the same time, we've been telling companies a Trump victory would also result in a lot of red tape cutting and lower compliance costs for them as Trump implements a deregulatory agenda, another kind of hallmark Republican policy, deregulation across the board. So the risk exposure is kind of a mixed bag, right? On the one hand, continuity under Biden is good for companies because it's stable, there's less regulatory upheaval, things kind of continue as they are. Under Trump, there's a bit of a whiplash, but at the same time, compliance costs will generally go down across a lot of sectors, but obviously the specific impacts vary a lot across sectors and what country you're from. Just one example, you know, we're working with a Japanese client in the frozen foods industry. They import a lot of food from Japan that they then sell in the US. So on the one hand, we expect that under Trump win, there will be a lot less food safety enforcement and lower compliance costs. But at the same time, Trump has also promised during his campaign to put a 10% on all foreign food imports, on all foreign imports. So there's also pretty significant trade risks. So kind of a mixed bag.
Just pressing a little further on that, as we always say, it's not just who's in power in the main role, but also the people around them and kind of the regulations that they're driving, the policies that they're driving. In the case of a second Biden administration, I think we can be pretty clear on more or less who the cabinet would be. With a Trump administration, that would be we wouldn't know. I mean, we expect most likely Robert Lighthizer, the former U.S. Trade Representative, might come back. But unlike the last time Trump was elected, when it was a bit of a surprise, even I think to him, we are seeing across Washington think tanks and policy people around the Trump camp developing policy. So if you think about the America First Policy Institute, for example, there is some more formal thinking around the Trump camp in the run-up to the election. So my question just briefly for you is, does that matter? Does that give us more of insight into the potential direction of travel of Trump administration policy such that it might be less unpredictable for business than the last time around? Or is it the case, do you think, that personnel changes may happen so quickly anyways that we'll still have that same level of unpredictability that we saw, you know, 2017, 2018 timeframe?
Well, it's a big question. And once again, I think it's probably going to come down to individual sectors, depending on how well hashed out some of the policies are. But there's absolutely a much stronger push within Republican thought leadership to get the Trump administration prepared ahead of time so that a second term Trump administration could really hit the ground running. The last election of Trump in 2016 really caught everyone by surprise. And there's a widespread perception that it took a lot of time to get his presidency off the ground, to formulate an agenda, get people in key positions, basically, you know, to get the whole governance presidency, White House up and running. But this time, Trump has most of the Republican establishment already behind him. And you've mentioned, you know, some of the conservative groups in D.C., including the Heritage Foundation. They're releasing playbooks for Trump's first year in office, what the policy agenda should be and who should be in what role. So I do think it's fair to say that things will be much better planned and executed this time around. And I have been pointing companies, you know, to the playbook I just mentioned, the Heritage Foundation Project 2025, I believe is called The Conservative Promise, A Mandate for Leadership, which is basically an agency by agency guide suggesting new policies written by former Trump White House staffers. So we know that they're close to the president. We know that the policy is pretty closely aligned with Trump's own views. So yes, I think that companies can probably go have a look in there and have a pretty good idea of what the Trump agenda will be and who will be in charge.
We will return to the conversation with Dan shortly. Please do click on the link in our podcast notes to follow our Asia in Focus podcast series, where we will be bringing regular updates from all across the region. And if you're looking for more of such analysis and insights from our experts all over the world, please visit the Our Thinking section on our website at www.controlrisk.com. And now let's continue the conversation with Dan. So let's bring it back to Asia. We have many offices all across Asia, as you know, and we spend kind of all day, every day talking to those clients, about business risks and obviously the U.S. election and the direction of travel again for policies that relates to the global business is at the forefront of everyone's mind. What can we expect either way to be the impact for Asia?
So there are a couple of things. There's, you know, individual country relationships with Asia. There's also broader Asia. There's political, there's economic, there's security relationships. All of these will have slightly different impacts. I think, you know, if we want to talk about China, which is the chief animator of discussions on geopolitical rivalry here in DC, I think that we can expect either candidate, so either Biden or Trump, to continue taking a pretty hardline approach on China. There's pretty much a bipartisan consensus across apolitical bureaucrats, across political appointees here in DC. As in recent years, you know, a second term Biden or Trump policy would basically be to restrict the flow of advanced technologies to China, and then also put on protectionist policies such as inbound investment and trade restrictions on the U.S. to basically protect domestic industries from Chinese overcapacity and from competition with Chinese companies. So the results of this, as we've seen in the past couple of years, will once again be continued bifurcation across certain supply chains. But this also increases the opportunities for third countries like Malaysia, like Vietnam, India, Mexico, and other countries that have strong manufacturing bases to kind of step in and fill some of these gaps. Meanwhile, advanced economies like Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, they can also take advantage of some of this bifurcation because there's opportunities where departing U.S. and Chinese companies leave behind. So just, you know, an example is the U.S. is currently welcoming investments from advanced economies in its own clean energy sector. And, you know, these investments probably would have been filled by China had the U.S. not restricted China from these supply chains. So all of this increases risk, but also raises opportunities from companies from third countries. And we've been getting many requests from such companies about how different U.S. election scenarios would impact their specific countries and sectors. So, for example, I'm currently working with a Japanese mining client right now that is looking to invest in U.S. lithium extraction. And obviously, lithium is a very important input to many clean energy technologies. And Biden is currently granting preferential market access and incentives to these kind of projects to U.S. allies like Japan. But our clients are really, they want to know if these incentives and these preferential treatment would go away if Trump is reelected. And there's a good chance that a lot of it would. So that's a pretty big impact for Asia. And another point that I'd like to make that's relevant to the region is, you know, while either Trump or Biden would be tough on China, I do think that the way the U.S. engages with allies to achieve some of its political, economic, and security aims for the region would be very different under these two presidents. As you kind of mentioned a little bit earlier, and as we saw in Trump's first term, he's really much more interested in bilateral engagements in Indo-Pacific, and he also takes a much more transactional and slightly less diplomatic approach to engaging with our allies there. So I think probably Trump would still try to rally friends to, you know, for example, block adoption of Huawei technologies or work on export controls together. But the emphasis would be much less on building a consensus-based approach through U.S. multilateral partnerships that we've seen under Biden. Trump would also likely de-emphasize the U.S.-China diplomatic re-engagement that has been rebuilt in the past year and a half. And I think, you know, diplomacy, when it goes away, is always destabilizing. And it would be destabilizing, certainly, for Asia-Pacific as the U.S. and China kind of return to that pre-2023 trading barbs publicly without any sort of pressure release mechanism. I think probably also some of the multilateral initiatives, especially the ones that have the Biden stamp on them, would come under threat. So Trump, you know, depending on the initiative, Trump may seek to pull out, defund, or rebrand them. I'm thinking of AUKUS, the security grouping with Australia, UK, and now potentially with Japan, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is Biden's proposed economic framework for the region, and the Mineral Security Partnership, which cooperates on critical minerals. But, you know, there's also many others. And the last regional impact that I'd like to highlight is going to be trade. As I mentioned at the top, Trump has promised to implement a 10% universal baseline tariff on all imports and a 60% tariff on all imports from China specifically. So if that actually comes to pass, that would obviously have a huge impact on regional and global market volatility. It would raise trade risks for companies across the board, and it would have all sorts of other impacts, like increasing trade with third countries that step in to fill that gap.
Yeah, there's indeed a number of areas, and a lot of our clients are looking at multiple points that you've just outlined there. So indeed, a lot to watch. I have one more question for you before we wrap up, and that's on Ukraine and just the broader global security architecture, because that's obviously also very relevant for business. So we just saw the House of Representatives, of course, pass the long-awaited bill for $61 billion of a military aid package to Ukraine. And I mention that because sitting here in Asia, quite a lot of businesses are looking at, again, the direction of travel of U.S. support to Ukraine as it would relate then to Ukraine's ability to stand firm with the Russian aggression, which then has implications for not just global supply chains, which of course a lot of people are looking at, but also just the overall NATO architecture. What's happening with the security architecture in Europe does matter here in Asia, because you do see countries like Japan and South Korea thinking about remilitarizing if indeed the global security architecture is changing. So I just wanted to get your very brief comments on how you think a Trump or a Biden administration might approach the issue of Ukraine and security in Europe and NATO more broadly, to the extent that it would have a knock-on impact to Asia?
Yeah, it's a great question, and perhaps among the most important, because obviously security is the most threatening of all risks. I think that, under Biden, like we said before, there would be a lot of continuity regarding embracing multilateralism and partners and investing in those partnerships. So I think that we would see those continue to be nurtured by the U.S. I think that in the case of a Trump presidency, that some of the isolationist tendencies of the U.S. would probably return that we saw in the first term. This would threaten disunity among U.S. allies on Ukraine, on other security groupings around the world. The White House cannot withdraw the funds from Ukraine that have been appropriated from Congress that you just mentioned. Those have not yet been passed. As of the taping of the podcast, it seems quite likely that they will pass. And if they do, the president cannot unilaterally withdraw that funding. But the White House can, to a pretty large extent, curtail aid to military cooperation with and political support for Ukraine. It can, certainly throw sands in the gears of things like weapons exports to Ukraine. It can also stop going to the coordination meetings on Ukraine with allies, for example. So on NATO, whether or not Trump formally leaves NATO, the U.S. Congress would likely intervene to stop such an action, but the deprioritization of it and other multilateral agreements would almost certainly harm the U.S.-led alliance structure. Similarly, you mentioned South Korea, Japan, whether or not the U.S. can actually withdraw troops from Korea, probably most likely Congress would once again step in, passing a law saying that the president cannot unilaterally pull troops from South Korea. But to be honest, I think when allied countries start seeing that that is the intention of the United States, that's kind of almost as strong an impact as actually doing it, because countries lose confidence in, they turn to militarization. In some cases, they turn to, more nuclearization. So I think that probably under Trump presidency, we'd see a reduced engagement in multilateral security and economic initiatives in both Europe and the Indo-Pacific, and a much larger return to isolationism like we saw in the first term Trump presidency.
Dan, so much to discuss. You've really done a great job walking us through the myriad issues and the follow-on implications for business, particularly here in Asia. Thank you for being so generous with your time and for this great discussion. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. That's all for today's Asia in Focus. If you enjoyed this episode, please do subscribe to our podcast channel so that you can receive all new episodes just as soon as they are released. Thank you so much.
If you enjoyed what you heard on this episode of Asia in Focus, be sure to subscribe. And make sure to check out our other podcasts as well. All of our podcasts are available wherever you listen. Just search Control Risks. You can follow all of our analysis and find out how we're helping businesses build organizations that are secure, compliant, and resilient by visiting controlrisks.com.